Warning, this podcast contains bad words and stories about drugs and sex and overthrowing the government. Proceed with caution. Okay. Thank you. And now on to our show. Wake up, brother, we got nothing to do. Let's go outside, just me and you, and build a fort. We'll pack a lunch, won't be home till after dark. Then after dinner we can sneak back out. You know that high school girl I've been telling you about? Well, she gets undressed about a quarter to nine, and we can watch her do it from the big old pine next door. She got a room on the second floor. Well, looks like another fucked up day in paradise.
Greetings, and come on in to episode 024 of the Daughter of God cast, the story of the making of the sci-fi featurette Daughter of God, and a few other movies, too. This is episode 024, Crazy, and we're deep into shirking Daughter of God for water and sunshine. In episode 023, we left the 16-foot Hobie catamaran Hello World anchored in familiar Traverse City after about 10 days and approximately 100 miles of open water sailing. In search of sustainable civilizations, I shot interviews at the Schooner Festival and Homegrown, a local organic eatery. I also needed to tweak the rig and tune my ensemble of components. Analogy. I discovered that my alcohol stove demanded undrinkable denatured alcohol rather than the multi-purposed grain alcohol I had stocked up on, so I swapped for my much hotter Whisperlite white gas stove. I needed the charger for my laptop, a new paddle, and Steve's bike was going to come along too. A dash of this and a teaspoon of that. The recipe for life, for exploring what we are, improvising the pancakes as we go along, making me. I rode my narrative sci-fi short as far as I could. The life recipe required other ingredients. I needed the wild earth, risk, freedom, discovery, physicality, the sensibility of traveling rough. As above, so below. The adjustments to the expedition's gear were an analog. The trip itself was an adjustment to my creative process. Crazy. Melanie sent me emails at the start and end of the 2009 expedition. From Melanie. Subject, the dread pirate Greenbeard. Date, September 7th, 2009. To Dan Kelly. Ahoy there! I saw your journey down the Alberta Channel, first from the cabbage shed and then Frankfurt Park. I went to a band party for a while with the plan of ending up at the beach Saturday night, but got trapped at the other party. I wonder where you are now. Everyone's talking about you. They all think you are crazy. I do too, and I'm really glad for it. Everyone else is boring. Lecho drom. Safe journey in Romani. Kiss and a hug, M. And then from Melanie, subject, you rock, exclamation point, exclamation point, exclamation point, exclamation point, exclamation point, exclamation point. Date, September 30, 2009, to Dan Kelly. I keep having dreams about the water and fish and boats. It's calling. My granddad was a seaman, as his father before him and his also. The seaman in my blood is pulling me. That sounds really gross. Your journey is stoking my ache. I remember a time in Alaska when I never thought I'd live on land again. Boy, has my life changed. When people tell me you are crazy for what you are doing, I think they are wrong. They are crazy for never doing it. How alive are you feeling? Cold? Weather-beaten? You know exactly where you are and what the fuck you are doing. There are no slumbering zombies on water. No complacent, entertainment-entranced, bobble-headed couch potatoes. There is a man in a very funny outfit, on a tiny open raft, merging with the elements, facing forward, making his own story. According to the standards of convention, of course I was crazy. I could have died. I could have woken up. I could have shed the assumptions and paradigms that keep Americans matrixed. I want a real country. I want a just and sustainable world. I want things that no one should dare want because, according to sane perspectives, they are impossible. I got arrested in 2003 protesting a war, but America is war. Way before George W. Shock and Awe, through Obama, the hep face of empire, to 2017 and the authentic face, Trumpy. Welcome to the national acid trip, staring into a mirror and unable to look away. If Trumpy bothers you, maybe you are at last ready to really live. How do we get our country back? In my lifetime of 50-plus years, I've never had a country. The USA is ever diverging from democracy. What country do we want back exactly? Ask first, how do I take myself back? How do I feel about me? Am I enabling a suicidal culture with self-loathing? Am I too fat, too short, too numb, too white? Does my self-concept suck? Am I practicing a perspective that supports a global horror show? The first worthy action is to own myself. Back in 2003, when I got arrested, made life miserable for my parents, blew off being comprehensible, went on the road, and then eventually ambled through the Palm Springs Short Festival. I want to movie. There was a becoming implied. I had finally taken responsibility for my own experience, and my authentic desires started percolating up. A sketch for a blueprint, for a prototype. We are the change we wish to see. We can't sow anger and reap love. We can't judge and expect justice. We are what we practice as individuals and collectively. We are choice incarnate, the walking, talking results of our decisions. Yes, there's been training. We've been schooled and acclimated and conformed to the norm. And that might be sticky, but it's not permanent. We re-choose. In 2009, I am on a catamaran, my home in the open air, setting the world record for aquatic tiny houses, for gypsy wagons on the water. 36 square feet of trampoline. Going where? In circles, just like Mother Earth. And the going, in this very specific way, is just another ingredient in the recipe for me. A going as a making. The going is the making. Crazy! I'm having so much fun rediscovering the OnDesire.com expedition blog and the movies that I want to saunter through these adventures in detail. But maybe better to scamper, stepping only on the stones most prominently poking above the stream. My plan was to do maybe 2 to 3 episodes for each of the 2 ALM expeditions, which would get us into 2011 by mid-March, halfway to the present. I'm having an intuition today about curating the content efficiently. In episode 023, we dipped into the pragmatics of navigating a tiny boat around an inland sea. Power, food, shelter, time, distances, communication. Stretching out in various yogic postures for hours, tiller gripped with feet and thighs while blogging on an iPhone or talking into the camera. Mostly, though, just being. Hours of meditation. That does something to a guy. Sailing up and out to places I've never been, in a way I'd never tried. Here's the premise of Around Lake Michigan, as articulated in March of 2010. We know sustainable civilizations will show up within the next 10 to 15 years, because if they don't, we are doomed. Since we expect to survive, sustainable civilizations are a given. Obviously, civilizations don't just pop into existence overnight. They take time to emerge. Therefore, we should expect to find fragments and partially assembled components of sustainable civilizations scattered everywhere around the planet, right now. These artifacts of the future can be discovered and shared. We can extrapolate from them and understand what they imply. They can show us how to align ourselves with the emergence. Around Lake Michigan is a search for sustainable civilizations, or more precisely, a discovery of the emergent artifacts that presage sustainable civilizations. A detective story, really. Finding the clues that point to how we survived, how we averted apocalypse, establishing a deep feed with the wilds, and asking every kook who happened along if they'd seen any sustainable civilizations. Those were my two main methodologies.
Ah, look at that rough beard. That rough piratey beard you got there. Arr.
Jeff's Place. Posted on September 13th, 2009 by Dan from ondesire.com. At the home of Jeff Gibbs, friend and advisor, mentor even, feisty ally, and occasional pain in the ass. He's offering me a base of operations for reorganization and resupply here in Traverse City. I'm off to the Schooner Festival to see if there's some fragment of sustainable civilizations there. More soon. Excellent interviews at the Schooner Festival with Tom Kelly, Master of the Inland Seas.
Because a sailboat was a traditional vessel for the Great Lakes. There were schooners like this at any given time in the late 1800s, for instance. You could see up to 150 schooners just like this in Grand Traverse Bay. The context in terms of today is that it provides a link to the past, it provides a link to the present, and it provides a link to the future.
Why? What about
because
the future?
The future is not hydrocarbon.
I'd like to think that there was a big future for sail and other types of non-traditionally powered vessels.
Why? Why would you like to think that?
Well, if you read the newspaper, you know that fuel costs are up and that there is somewhere in the future there is going to be an end to cheap fuel, cheap fossil fuel. And so we have to just be thinking a little bit outside the box on how we can transport people and goods in a more economical way. And that may include sail or other things that are different than what we're doing now.
Is that anywhere in the Inland Seas mission to think about how that might actually be promoted or at least explored?
Well, I guess it's part of our mission in that we're an example, I suppose, of... We could have purchased a powerboat to do the same thing we're doing now.
Of course.
Except that there's so many lessons we can teach kids that have to do with sailing,
yep.
That have to do with physics, and we're showing how you can do what we're doing and use relatively small amount of fuel. I mean, we still have a diesel engine
of course.
Here, but we try not to run it
yep.
That much.
Yep.
And so it's a pretty economical operation.
And upkeep of the boat, maintenance, cheaper than a motorboat or the same size?
It's probably about the same.
About the same.
You don't have the engines to take care of, but you do have
sails.
The sails and the rigging and that sort of thing. And it's probably more labor intensive as far as your crew and stuff. You've got more maintenance things to do on a sailboat this size than you would on a powerboat this size. But I think the rewards are also much greater to us.
Ray Minervini of Grand Traverse Commons.
What's your deal, Ray? What do you do?
We're rehabbing Building 50, actually almost all of the buildings at the former State Asylum. There's 1 million square feet total development capacity, about 750,000 square feet of existing buildings, and we're restoring, rehabilitating
all of
the buildings.
How long have you been working on this for?
7 years. Actual construction, about almost six now. And we've completed about 250,000 square feet of building thus far.
Uh-huh.
And we still have, obviously, another 600,000 square feet of existing building to rehab. And then some additional development capacity that will probably build some upper floors on some of the flat-top buildings.
Now, what was the logistics of this? Did you actually kind of capture the rights to do development there? Did you buy it outright? How did it work?
We purchased the site
uh-huh.
With the condition that we would rehab the buildings. And the first thing that we did, of course, when the state knew that they were going to abandon the buildings, they stopped shingling the roofs and repairing the roofs, and, of course, water poured into the buildings. Water's the enemy. You can lose a building in a hurry when you don't have shingles on the roof.
That's right.
And the first thing that we did was to shingle the whole of Building 50, 1,500 square, quarter mile long, 400,000 square foot building.
Mm-hmm.
And the unfortunate reality, as you know, in this country is that we don't cherish antiquity. We demolish it.
Yep.
And it's very difficult for us to think about buildings having a different use. As soon as whatever use is in the building leaves the building, the first thing people are thinking about if they can't find the same kind of use to go back into the building. For example, when the auto plant is not an auto plant, what does it become? You know,
yep.
When the furniture factory is no longer a furniture factory, it's difficult for us to think of it becoming something else. And, you know, adaptive reuse is the key buzzword, you know, that what we have to keep in mind now is what we need to do. You go to Europe, and of course you see in Europe that they cherish antiquity.
Yep.
You know, and they don't demolish buildings, and they save them. You know, we have a different mentality in this country.
Mm-hmm.
We're too quick to demolish. And as a matter of fact, when the state vacated the building, they had planned to demolish it. And there were grassroots efforts here in Traverse City that really resulted in, you know, enough of a groundswell of public support to preserve the buildings. And that, you know, that's, you know, we share that same sentiment, is that, you know, what are we thinking about demolishing these remarkable buildings?
Yeah.
Well, you know, there's 10 million bricks. These buildings are all solid masonry. They've got limestone foundations that go very deep into the ground, built by the state when they built things to last 1,000 years.
Right.
There's absolutely no reason to demolish that building, you know?
Yep.
We just need to have a different mindset and say, okay, what else can this building become? And what our strategy was from the beginning was to create as much of a mixed zoning to allow for the buildings, to let the market demands dictate what the buildings become.
Mm-hmm.
The buildings are a challenge because they're solid masonry walls and solid masonry interior partitions, so when you want to reconfigure the building, it becomes a challenge. Institutional buildings like a hospital are much more difficult to rehab than, say, an old furniture factory.
Right.
The furniture factory is one big open space.
Yeah, it's a big clear space.
Yeah. And unfortunately, the way that the State Historic Preservation Office and the National Park Service, which are the state and national entities that control what happens with old buildings, their standards allow for you to take a big, large warehouse space and reconfigure it into smaller spaces.
Yep.
But they don't allow you to take a hospital with a lot of small rooms and open up to create, you know, residential opportunities or commercial opportunities. And therein lies the challenge, and that's why we're saving old warehouses and demolishing old hospitals and other old buildings like those hospitals.
That are not so easy to rehab.
Because, right, they're very, very difficult to rehab and to meet the standards of the National Park Service and the State Historic Preservation Office. The building that we're rehabbing right now is referred to as a Kirkbride. Kirkbride was the psychiatrist who conceived this notion of humane treatment of the mentally ill. And the Kirkbrides were the first of the asylums that were constructed around the country. And they're differentiated from subsequent asylums in as much as that they were long and linear. And the whole notion was to create opportunities for natural light, natural ventilation. And so they built the buildings very narrow and very long. And they also had they weren't perfectly straight. You know, they had little offsets in them and everything else, so that they created opportunities for some privacy.
Gotcha.
And yet phenomenal windows for ventilation. And at the time when they built the Traverse City facility, as they did with almost all the other facilities that were built all around the country, the Kirkbrides, that is, they usually put them in a beautiful part of town up on a hill so that it had commanding views. And the whole notion was that beauty was therapy, and that if they put a patient in a beautiful environment, that would all help with the healing process.
Wow.
And
what a concept.
Total. Yeah, really remarkable. And, you know, it's there are views, great views of the bay, actually, from up on the... Now that the urban canopy's grown up, you have to go to the higher floors, but at one time you could see right from the ground level, you could see the bay. Now you have to go up to the upper floors, but you could see the bay and see the ships sailing in, which is pretty cool.
Right on.
Yeah. So what we've done is we've completed about one half of the main building, which is a 400,000 square foot building. We've completed about 200,000 square feet of it. And we've created that mix of use. We've got the Mercado. The lower level is retail, restaurant, deli, you know, gelato shop, some clothing stores.
Right.
Kind of a mix of uses in the garden level. And then the next floor above is commercial. doctor's office, a fitness center, a salon, different commercial offices.
Right.
And then the floors above that are residential. So we have condos, 62 condos thus far built out within the building.
Wow.
And 60 of them are sold. So
wow.
So if you live there in your condo, you can take the elevator down to the garden level, walk through the garden level, go down to Stella Restaurant for dinner, or go over to the deli to pick up a bottle of wine or lunch.
It sounds to me like it could be profitable.
It's beginning. This is something new. We haven't built our environment like this in the past. We used to do it. We used to create
those
mix of uses. If you go to any little small town like Traverse City, you'll see the commercial on the lower levels of the buildings. Usually they had offices above that, and then above that they had residential. You know, the people who owned the buildings lived above the stores.
Sure.
And well, then what happened is in the 50s, 1950s, we began isolating uses, separating uses. And what we started to do, and I grew up in Detroit, and I grew up in Detroit when it was a beautiful city. That gives you a clue of how old I am.
Nah.
But Detroit was the first place in the world, the first mall in the world was built in Detroit, outside of Detroit. Actually, it was built in Southfield. They had no idea if it was going to work. It was a new experiment.
Wow.
And they built this huge facility, the Northland Mall.
Yep.
Way out in the country, and it worked, and it was amazingly successful. And in the history of man, that was the first time that we've really taken and built, you know, such a huge mercantile center out in the middle of the country.
Yep.
And it did work, and it was the beginning of sprawl as we know it, you know, because then we started building suburbs, and of course, then again, with the isolating and separating of uses, the suburbs went over here on this side of town, and then the shopping mall went on that side of town, and the office park went over here, and the industrial park went over there, and the schools went here, and we spend 5 hours a day driving around in a circle chasing our tails.
And that's the 500-pound gorilla is the car.
The car.
Because without the car, you couldn't get to that mall.
We build our environment now for the automobile. We don't build it for people.
Right.
That's why all the really, truly beautiful places in the world, in my mind, are the places that were built for people. That's when you go to Europe and you go to any of the major cities in Europe, there's just remarkable places. Our cities as well. You know, the downtowns of our cities, a lot of them were built prior to the automobile. You know, now, is parking a problem? Yeah. Get out of your car.
Yeah.
You know, get out of your car and walk.
Yeah.
You know, the reality is that you don't interact with people when you're in your car. The best you might be doing is flipping them off, you know, because they cut you off or something. You know, and a car takes up a lot of space. When you're walking down the street, you know, you have an opportunity to interact with people.
Sure.
You know? And so you smile, you wave, and you get to know that person.
That's right.
You know?
And your environment, trees going by,
absolutely.
And bushes, and grass.
Right.
And
yeah. So the building, fortunately, the building that we're in was built before the automobile. There were 3,500 people who lived there, none of them drove. So it was an environment created for people. And it's actually been a battle for us to continue this with this philosophy about creating an environment for people. That's what we want to maintain. Everybody, of course, says the zoning requirements are that you have to have parking. Yeah. Well, we can create parking in this beautiful arboretum of spectacular 150-year-old trees, but we got to cut the trees down to do it.
Yep.
No, we're not going to do that.
Right.
You know, we're going to fit parking wherever we can fit it. We're going to invite people to get out of their cars and have this opportunity for conviviality, you know, an opportunity to interact.
Has there been any thought about trying to get some waivers on that parking restriction?
We have. It took a while. It took a few years, but when we showed what the options were, we did finally get that waived.
Nice.
And but it is still a battle, though. And the unfortunate reality is, just to give you an example, if you wanted to build a building anywhere, even if you wanted to rehab an old building, the first thing that you have to do when you go to the building department is that you tell them what the use of the building is going to be. And then they designate through their charts how many parking spaces you have to have for that building. And then they ask you not what you're going to do to the building, but how are you going to park all those cars? And let's see your site plan first. Before you can get an approval to do anything with the building and take care of people, you got to show how you're going to take care of the cars.
Unbelievable.
And you know, it's very frustrating because, you know, we really, truly do need to change our mindset. You know, we do need to get out of our car, you know, and if you want to really build true sustainability, that's what we need to do, you know, and Fortunately, here in Traverse City, we have a very progressive planner who understands. And if you, I think Russ Soaring and his staff, they've done a really remarkable job. And Traverse City is a place, a community that has changed its ordinances and has to allow and to create more opportunities, you know, more urbane opportunities. And we need to do that, obviously, more and more. We need to do that as opposed to going out in the, well, with the, our site is 1 million square feet of redevelopment capacity. It's a brownfield site. It's smart growth. It's cool cities. It's, you know, sustainable. It's all the buzzwords.
Yep,
it's,
yep.
We're the poster child right now, yep. You know, for what we really need to be doing. Because that 1 million square feet of development can happen in that location where we're at, which is really, again, the poster child setting, or it can happen out in a cornfield, you know, south of town, or, you know, destroying some beautiful woods.
Yep.
We need to keep that open space. We need,
yep.
It. And that's what, look at it, we're here in Traverse City. It's just remarkable. We got all these people that are here and loving and enjoying this remarkably beautiful place, and we need to keep it a remarkably beautiful place.
Yep.
And we can do that,
yep.
You know.
Yeah.
But that sustainability link is so crucial, you know. Let's maintain these buildings downtown. Population of Traverse City is 15,000 at the turn of the 1800s. At the end of the 1800s, it was 15,000. Population has, wow, not increased. What we need to have is a little more density in town. Actually, I think the population is a little bit less than what it was.
Yeah.
You know, because there were more residential opportunities, you know, and some of the buildings have been demolished.
Yes.
And some, there's some warehouse space that's not being used.
Yeah.
You know, so, and the same with the facility where we're at, the Old State Hospital. You know, we're going to create ultimately probably 300 to 400 residential units there.
Wow.
But we'll also have that mix because, yep, we'll have that, the elements of community, you know, and that's the key, is that having that mix is so important. And it's also important to have the social economic mix and the multi-generational mix. I mean, in order to really have community, you need to have all of the elements. So what
that's
we've,
right,
done is we've created some really small efficiency apartments that are very, very affordable,
mm-hmm,
and we have some very nice luxury condos.
So we have a mix of all different kinds of people.
We have, right, so we have from 18 years old to 88 years old,
nice,
living in the building.
Nice.
We have $70,000 affordable condos, and we have some $1 million-plus condos.
Wow.
And they're neighbors, and
nice,
they get it.
They get it, yeah?
They get it. Neighbors get it, and they love that mix, you know?
Wow.
Evelyn Shelagowski is in her 80s, is always taking care of Ray because she's making me pierogies and brings them over. And make sure make sure you eat these right. They're hot right now. You know, come on. I'm not leaving until you eat, you know. But that's community, you know.
Righteous. That's
that's
great.
What you need.
Ray, are you living in the buildings too?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. That's awesome. Hey, use your product.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's a great place. It's we're fortunate. We live in a place like Traverse City.
And Tanya and Chris from Homegrown.
Here you guys are in this little tiny building next to the Midas, or near the Midas Muffler Shop. You're serving organic food. What are you guys thinking?
We're crazy.
So 3 years so far?
Yeah, just over 3 years.
And it's going well?
Yes.
What was the motivation? What's your philosophy here? What are you trying to accomplish? I mean, obviously you're making food, but what are you really trying to do?
Well, initially, our family was really sick. We didn't eat any organic foods. We're talking about seizures, asthma, severe allergies, acid reflux, to where we were around the age of 28, and we're on 7 prescription drugs per month between my 2 children and my husband.
Wow. How old are your kids?
Then they were, currently they're 10 and 14, so it was about 4 years ago. So without getting any answers from any of the doctors or continually asking questions, we came to research on our own, having a lot of things point back to our diet. And so I started researching on food labels, ingredients, pretty much gave away every bit of food in our house to the local food pantry and went 100% organic, like, overnight almost. The kids and my husband weren't very pleased with that. They thought that I was completely crazy.
That husband over there.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thought I was crazy.
Okay,
thought
keep
I
going.
Lost my mind. And about 4 months into it, my husband actually missed an acid reflux pill. And typically, he would be in misery for like 2 days afterwards. And he said he felt fine. So within 6 months of eating 100% organic, we were off all of the prescriptions. We used to eat out a lot. We used to enjoy going out as a family. And we were you know, we were being invited by family members, friends to go here, go there. We couldn't go. The food was not clean enough for us. And we just got frustrated with that and figured other people were frustrated with that as well, not being able to grab something that's clean and quick. And we just wanted people to start trying organic food. What is organic and what does that mean? People were making horrible faces at our food. You know, family, friends, they thought it was something very strange. Then we got them to start tasting it, and that was kind of our goal with our American menu. We can get pizzas, burgers, sandwiches, something that's not completely outside of the American box. And by the end of the meal, they're just wowed. So they just really didn't understand the whole concept of what organic food is. And we figured out that this was going to be our lifestyle from start to finish. We sold our huge home. We sold our second car. We moved from a 2,300 square foot home to a 750 square foot apartment. We lowered all of our kind of needs and wants and material things. A lot of people say they can't afford organic food. Well, we gave up everything to afford organic food. And now we have more energy and more sustainability, I feel, in our life.
What do you mean you have more sustainability? What's that mean?
People ask us all the time how we work as much as we do, and we attain it all through the food that we put in our bodies. My husband works about 100 plus hours a week, and I work about 80 hours a week, plus we have two children, one being a special needs child. So
wow.
We are busy, busy, busy all the time.
You actually had more energy to sustain your life.
Right.
Do you feel like you have found kind of a mission?
Yes, I have. I feel like you can tell people all day long, you need to eat healthy, you need to make better choices for your life, you need to do this, you need to do that. But when you tell somebody that you came off of 7 major prescription medications in a 6-month period of time, that's a claim that nobody can deny. I absolutely tell anyone I can, because I think it's really important that people understand that there are other choices than having to go to the doctor and refill prescriptions every month and not really get an answer or a cure. And mostly because you can tell people all day long that organic food tastes good, but they don't believe you till they try it. So that's why we thought of the restaurant. We just want more and more people to become aware of what we discovered through a really long, disheartening process of several years of medication, several years of watching my daughter inhale steroids and not getting any better. A couple of years of watching my husband have seizures. I was a stay-at-home mom at the time. He was working outside the home. It was a very scary time for us, and we weren't getting any answers. So I feel like helping a family maybe understand before they get to that point or in the earlier process of being sick and being frustrated with the no-answer kind of doctor visits and prescriptions kind of being thrown at you, I'd really like to help them in an aspect of just educating them in any way that I possibly can, answering any of their questions, sending them to resource places. Because once you start, I feel like it's an endless abyss of education, and just one thing just keeps leading you to another. I'm on about 4+ years of researching on my own about organic clean foods and chemicals in the home. And I swear that every single time I finish one thing, it just leads me right into another. It's just a never-ending. I'm still finding out more and more and more information almost every day. I was very saddened that I felt like I didn't make the choices to figure this out a little sooner for them. So I was initially saddened, but I've moved on from there. And very quickly, I realized I only did what I could with what I had at the time, and so I can't be myself up anymore, because I felt like, you know, there was just a lot of things. My son has cerebral palsy. He was at birth put on an anti-seizure medication, and at the age of 8, we found out that he was only supposed to be on that medication as a trial basis for the first few months. And it actually causes learning disabilities, which he already has with the major holes in his brain. So I gave him a prescription medication that caused even more learning disabilities for about 6 years too long. And would have continued that medication as well had I not started asking questions, and then the doctors realized, oh, well, he's not supposed to be on that any longer. So, you know, there's different things like that that make you feel a little discouraged, but also empowered immensely when I no longer have to go back to the pharmacist. We actually haven't even had to be on an antibiotic. We used to have about 4 to 6 antibiotics each winter for the various family members, depending on who, strep throat, tonsillitis, sinus infections. We haven't even had to fill an antibiotic in over 3 years. I don't think it's going to be on the front page of the media newspaper. I don't think it's going to be on the evening news. Although they've done blurbs about it, it's just not enough to really change a huge percentage of the Americans' view on what we're doing.
It's pretty phenomenal. You see a little place, organic food, you know, okay. There's some you know, interesting people in there doing something, you know, what are they trying to do? And it turns out that it came from basically a desperate search for healing, answers in your life. And out of that, you say, okay, well, we need to basically change our diet because what we're eating is not helping us, it's hurting us, and medicine, prescription medicines aren't helping us. So let's see if there's another way, and there is another way. You find some solutions, you find some things happening in your health that's really positive, you're feeling better, and then it occurs to you, well, maybe there's a way to actually bring this to people, because you can't be the only ones out there.
No. All right.
Right. And so in that process of going, you know, going through that, basically, it's a huge renaissance of your life, and, you know, shifting everything, as you say, making some serious financial changes to basically make this possible, to launch this. And on top of all that, you're starting your first business. You guys have never had your own business before this. So, in a way, and it's not like you're just new on the block. You've been here 3 years now?
Yes.
So, in a way, it's a kind of a little bit miraculous, in a way. You guys feel like there's something something kind of special going on around you with this whole thing?
I do. I mean, I feel like the way and the way that it had kind of worked out and when I actually discovered organic foods was kind of a energy that kind of drew us in that direction. I'm a big believer in paths and that we walk a certain path in certain times of your life.
Right.
You're drawn towards certain things. My husband, fortunately, just pretty much did every job out there that you can imagine for the restaurant industry down to district managing.
Okay, good. Nice foundation.
Right, general managing.
So you knew something about this business?
Yes.
Okay.
All the way from a busser when he was a young teen all the way up to managing a large fine dining establishment. So
cool.
That was another big part of the puzzle just because my husband just had so much knowledge in that. He's lucky I work well with numbers, so the books came pretty easy to me.
Right. That's another key component.
Another key component. And then just the area in general. I think Traverse City has a lot of people in the organic community. I do believe that they supported us as well and helped us come as far as we have. Yeah, we don't have a lot of money, so our advertising budget is...
really minimal.
Yeah, or none.
Yep, got it.
You can pretty much say none.
Got it.
So we go on a lot of word of mouth. But in the 3 years that we've been open, we've actually only had 2 food complaints. We feel like we're putting out a pretty good product.
How has it affected your relationship?
Strengthened it, honestly. I mean, it's not been easy. Anyone who tells you, that they're in business with their spouse and it's easy, they're lying. 100%. I was very fortunate at a young age to find my best friend and marry her. And she's grown up with me and we've grown up together. And I would say our relationship has never been stronger than it is today. Maybe today we're foes and arguing about I need to spend money in this department where she needs to spend money in that department, and we're butting heads, but we also know that if there's anyone we can fall back on, it's each other. So we're way stronger than we were when we started, and I don't recommend it. I would say that. I would say that it takes a very special pair, for sure.
I mean,
Tanya and I have shown time and again throughout our marriage and our relationship from the time we were teens until now that we're definitely not the norm. We are far from the norm. And not only now with our lifestyle, but just the way that we are and how we got back together and all the things that we've done in our entire relationship from first meeting each other all the way till now. I mean, we're definitely different. But
we just celebrated our 11th wedding anniversary.
Right on. Congratulations. Wow. Yesterday. Cool.
Yeah.
11 is a good number.
It is.
Yeah, right. Woo!
I think that our marriage in general has never been very easy. We were pregnant at 19, had a daughter, and we, at 22, had a special needs child. So I don't think anything that has ever really kind of crossed our path in our marriage is ever, I would say, easy. But we have a great support system for each other. We pamper each other. And I really think that's what brings you back together when things are chaotic. He's just a really good, strong man, a hard worker, and yeah. I'm a pretty patient woman, and I work well with numbers somehow. I always make it work.
But what,
give up a little convenience and work a little more. The quality of life that you have, regardless of what it is, each minute's better.
You think that's a lesson that is translatable to other families, of giving up a little convenience and working a little harder for the right sorts of things?
The entire nation, the majority of the population, I don't know about worldwide, I haven't been in other countries. All I can do is go off what the television tells me. So I would say that I think the majority of society needs to stop, needs to throw out the wristwatches and the time clocks, and really focus a little bit more so on that time isn't our ruler, and a lot of people, especially in the American society, believe that, and convenience is what drives them to that. If they were all slow down and just take a minute and realize that, it's a bad analogy, but you can leave work 15 minutes earlier to spend time with your family, and that's okay. You can take a 45-minute lunch instead of a half-hour lunch and feed your body some good fuel. You can take an extra 15 minutes on your way to work and recycle the box of recycling you have. There's lots of different things that people could do if they would just slow down for just a few minutes, give themselves an extra hour a day. And that's just a small start. When we're done with this thing and we're retired, we're not, I know I'm not having a clock or a calendar.
Yeah.
I do not want to be married to the 365-day calendar year, 24 hours a day.
Well, and we feel good about it. You know, we feel good about the little waste that we put out. You know, like I said, my husband's worked at so many restaurants, and you see the endless waste going. It's nice to be able to know that we don't put out any grease. We don't have any, such a minimal amount of garbage a day. For a restaurant, it's pretty amazing.
What we did, especially in comparison, like Tanya said, with my background, I mean, I can't think on large or small scale, some of the smaller sort of I've had opportunity to work with, not so much work at, but work with, in season. This, granted, this has been probably our slowest summer due to the economy.
Yep.
However, I mean, it was our season, and I don't think we did more than, I would say, 3 full trash bags a week on their busiest time of trash.
Wow.
And the rest was all composted, recycled. I mean, and it's not that hard to do.
Are you guys a part of a sustainable civilization? Are you actually a little...
We're striving to be there, but I mean, look how much we're fighting.
Back in Beulah, posted on September 14th, 2009 by Dan from ondesire.com. I borrowed Jeff's car and returned to Crystal Lake last night for some quality time with Mr. Boy and to pick up a few items. Heading back to Hello World tonight. Look for a Tuesday afternoon or Wednesday morning departure from Traverse City. Caught some excellent interviews at the Schooner Festival yesterday with Tom Kelly, Master of the Inland Seas, Ray Minervini of Grand Traverse Commons, Andy Gale from Bay Area Recycling for Charities, and Tanya and Chris from Homegrown. Here's Hello World at anchor with majestic schooners in the background. The camera pulls back, and she's surrounded by smokers, motorboats. This shot is all about the ironic contrast between sail and smoke. Please ignore the sunbathers. They have nothing to do with this shot. Though perhaps one might find a striking resonance between svelte female anatomy and the sleek geometry of Hello World, or notice how nicely these women would both fit on the trampoline. Other than that, lounging bikini-clad hotties are not relevant to this purely documentary moment, illustrating an ironic contrast between a small footprint approach and, oh, whatever. Slow motion start. Posted on September 17th, 2009 by Dan from ondesire.com. The bustling urban milieu fades ever so slowly into a haze of jet exhaust and wood smoke. Bows angled toward the Arctic, I slither forward on an occasional puff of wind. 30+ miles before I can clear Grand Traverse Bay. With a bit more breeze, I might make it before dark. I've been at Jeff's the first and last two nights, with a visit to Crystal Lake in between to see the boy. When I wasn't tuning the travel kit, I was asking folks if they'd ever seen any sustainable civilizations. Busy 5 days. I've got Steve Ziliak's bike with me on the off chance I get to Canada and can give it back. It's slung a little close to the waterline, but I've since had a brainstorm for raising it up. I must be getting close to Hello World's max cargo capacity. Just before I left, I visited a crazy mofo who's refurbing a big cat, 40 feet, for ocean travel, powered by kite. Seems like a lot of boat for one dude. He could have a rack of bikes. Anchored at the tip of Old Mission. Posted on September 17th, 2009 by Dan from ondesire.com. After clawing my way out of Grand Traverse Bay for the better part of the afternoon, I decided to turn right and check out the tip of the Old Mission Peninsula for overnight potential. It looked quite picturesque, with seagulls and herons decorating verdant shoals and a white lighthouse. These are, of course, hints about the nature of the place as regards to sailboats. The tip of Old Mission is quite shallow and rocky. I swooped around the eastern shoal and ventured into a bay that only water birds and catamarans dare to enter. I bumped and clunked to the beach and landed. I didn't much like the vibe I got from the odd ducks, people, I saw pacing the beach, nor was the locale remote enough for camping. After consulting my iPhone charts, the new iPhone with working GPS, yay, I decided to scrape and squeal back out and reconnoiter the western edge of the peninsula. I checked the western shoals on the way out, but their stony and flora-entangled flanks were not ideal for pulling up a cat, though the birds seemed to dig them. Rounding them, I found a very wild shore with a little island nearby, an appealing setup. It was far too shallow to land Hello World, so I opted to anchor and sleep on the trampoline, a first, looking north from Old Mission Anchorage. Keep warm. Posted on September 17, 2009 by Gretchen Eichberger, The Science of Keeping Warm. Dressing to stay warm is all about slowing the transfer of heat from your body to the outside environment. Basically, you're trying to put your body heat in the best thermos possible. The process of heat transfer can be described quantitatively using the law of heat conduction, H equals KA dT over dx.
Is a constant determined by the insulating material. The K, or thermal conductivity of water, is 0.6. The thermal conductivity of air is 0.023. From this you can see that the
It's pretty easy to see that dry fleece is the way to go to maintain your body heat. Fruit fly friendship. Posted on September 18th, 2009 by Dan from ondesire.com. My bare back is covered with fruit flies. A delicious tingle like static electricity. That's this morning's update from the nitrogen accumulator, otherwise known as the Dung-O-Matic, trademark. I'd anchored on a pretty wild beach, and so was amazed to see them, feel them in such profusion. But of course, they have a life beyond humans. Another reason to get with nature, erotic encounters with wildlife. Anchored on Old Mission Peninsula western edge, and a special moment on the Dung-O-Matic. Old Mission to Barnes. Posted on September 18th, 2009 by Dan from ondesire.com. Brisk north wind of 15 knots with gusts up to 25. Then there were the waves, crest to trough 4 to 5 feet at times. Sail up and over, big splash, do it again. After about 14 miles of tacking northwest and northeast to move 9 miles north, I was ready for a break and a rope check. After running long vectors across the entire bay, I moved close to the east shore. The low dunes I'd spotted couldn't be identified with the iPhone, but they looked remote and cottage-free. As I approached, I picked out sunbathers. A friendly chap named Jerry helped pull up the cat and informed me that there was a campsite above the beach. $25 for powered sites or $21 for unpowered. So much for remote. A staff member at the Barnes campsite, Dylan, later told me I could stay on the beach as long as I wanted. I've decided to wait for the wind to slow and change direction from north to south as forecast. Plenty of nice folks here. Mark and Kathy of Onekama left me a care package. A staff member at Barnes Campsite, Dylan, later told me I could stay on the beach as long as I wanted. I've decided to wait for the wind to slow and change direction from north to south as forecast. Plenty of nice folks here. Mark and Kathy of Onekama left me a care package. Harvesting the sun to charge batteries and catch up on blogging. Draining the hulls. A lot of water came out. Maybe that's why the boat seemed sluggish in the big wind. Dinner by candlelight. Posted on September 19, 2009 by Dan from ondesire.com. The candle is optimally situated. The bowl of quinoa porridge with collard greens and button mushrooms steams in the foreground, illuminated enough so that one may design a fortunate arrangement of tasty morsels on one spoon. In the background, in fact, wrapped around and above the cozy bowl of porridge, everywhere the bowl is not, stars. I am eating at the edge of the cosmos tonight. Polite waves lap at the sand not more than 4 feet from my booties. It's 10:10, or rather 22:10, 2:10 UTC. My neighbors at Barnes Park Campground are snug in their pop-up campers or tents, each with their own version of petrol-powered Hello Worlds parked nearby. Are we sharing the same night, or am I alone in the theater of stars, gateway to the universe? Before bed, I visit the glistening facilities at the campground. Is this cheating? Dark Night of Charlevoix. Posted on September 20th, 2009 by Dan from ondesire.com. My iPhone had a mishap, so I'm recalling events from a future perspective, having lost several posts in process. Having left Barnes Park around 10:30 a.m. with its sparkling toilets, I made the dash for the end of Grand Traverse Bay and then, with a little luck, Beaver Island. I got an encouraging start, then stalled out coming up to Fisherman's Island Park. The wind was so lame I started for shore, then got encouraged by robot reports of decent south wind of 6 knots or so off Traverse Light. I persisted, and sure enough got a good few miles under me, getting within sight of the cement plant in Charlevoix. It was big and slow to pass by, in hindsight a dark omen. With the wind blowing and my new nightlights installed, I thought I could make Beaver even if I sailed into the evening hours. The forecasts were for a wind shift, but then steady strong breezes that I could ride north. I started towards Beaver, putting the cement plant on my stern. It dwindled over the next few hours, and off in the distance I could make out the weird shimmering phantasms that islands manifest when viewed from 15 miles away. I could see Beaver, and so could use both a compass and a visual fix to navigate. Airplanes from Charlevoix flew back and forth on the Beaver Run every hour or so, helping to point the way. Then, 5 miles or so from Charlevoix, the wind shift began to feel more and more like wind dying. At 7:30 p.m., I made the call. Turn back. Turn back. Becalmed in shipping lanes, with a frost advisory. Not a good situation. I spun around and watched the sun drop for another hour as I fitfully creeped back toward that awful cement plant. A rip-roaring sunset with pink beams streaking across the dome of the sky. Hello World going slower, slower, stopped. It's dusk and I'm paddling for some friendly-looking dunes to the west of town, about 2 to 3 miles away. After some confusion, my iPhone charts tell the story. The cement plant is the closest landfall. Now the ominous factor increases. Didn't Jeff mention that there was a nuclear plant up around these parts? Is that actually a nuclear power plant? Are those domes containment vessels? Wouldn't a nuclear power plant look more slick? What is Homeland Security going to think about a radical with an FBI record paddling a backpack-laden sailboat up to a nuclear power plant in the dead of night? A boat approaches, cautiously. They come around in a long, slow parabola, obviously casing me, probably doing a night vision scan for weapons of mass destruction, expecting twin hulls filled with thermite or rocket launchers disguised as tripods. Whoever they are, I feel unreasonably embarrassed to be naked, windless. A rakish sailboat shorn of all grace and speed, having no good reason to be out fumbling around in the deepening twilight. No, I don't want a tow. Probably.
I'm basically drifting, as opposed to sailing. Still about a mile away from my destination, where I'll go to sleep tonight. A motorboat came out to check on me, and I suppose I could have asked for a tow. But I didn't. He drove up and said, "All good?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm just waiting for some wind." And he said, "Okay." And he motored away, thinking that he wouldn't want to disturb my moment out here and insist on getting me in to shore. And that was very nice of him. People, I guess, respect each other's privacy. He just wanted to be sure I was okay. Now I'm warm enough, but the temperature is going to drop. 30 degrees tonight. That's what I heard. It's a frost warning. And that's interesting, isn't it? I'm wishing now that I had mounted the light on the rudder as I was imagining, because then I could see whether I had any little swirls, and I could continue to imagine that I was sailing as I drift like a derelict past the concrete plant with its lights and its low hum that obviously never ceases on a Saturday night at 9:30. It just goes on and on and on and on and on because they never stop making cement. And it's like that all over the world. They never stop making things all the time. They're making them 24/7. Around the clock, because they're in business.
Stubborn and totally screwed to the last. That's me. Around 9:30 p.m., a wind arrives, bringing me in, drawing me towards the ominous complex. My destiny is to sleep next to this mighty grumbling monster, whatever it is. I drive in towards the lights of town, tacking experimentally to see if I can somehow make those dunes. Nope, there's no escape. On the last tack, I'm driving into heaven knows what, a couple of hundred yards or so from concrete towers and domes. Suddenly bumping on shallow rocks, I dive for the rudder release. The boat slews around while I'm busy, and then there are huge rocks dead ahead. I spin the boat around and away from collision more by force of will than anything, and we run gently aground. It's not a beach, just big rocks guarding a marsh. A condo or commercial building with a few lit windows broods over the scene. The only option is to anchor and get into my sleeping bags, and quick. It's damn cold. I'll never get the wetsuit off in time to pee, so I just let go right there. Baptism. I vow to rinse it and me before getting into dry clothes. I jump off and drag the boat into deeper waters for anchor. The water feels toasty, a bad sign. The temperature of my extremities must be below the water temperature, 65 Fahrenheit or so. Gotta move quick and get warm. Wish I had read Gretchen's post about this very topic instead of just scanning it. What follows is a series of tedious but essential boat shutdown procedures, executed mostly in the dark and talking to myself encouragingly the whole time. Finally, sails down and stowed, and me up on the trampoline, rinsed, dressed, and ready to shut down. I get in the sleeping bag, slightly damp from yesterday's dew, and strip off my socks and bottoms. I have the overconfident notion that I'll keep them in the bag and dry them with my body heat, but nix that after my stone-frozen feet make it clear that I've got to focus all my body heat on me. I close the bags until there's only a snorkel opening for oxygen. It's 11 p.m. I drift off to the hum of American industry. An island called Beaver. Posted on September 20th, 2009 by Dan from OnDesire.com. There are disasters, problems, and blessings. Any life worth living is an admixture of these. So much life in a couple of days. First, my current position. at a power-enabled table in Danny Donegal's pub, Beaver Island, sipping an Oberon, Beaver style, with a slice of orange. Short on paper money, I'm trying to stretch my $10 minimum so I can sit here for a couple of hours to charge batteries and copy memory cards. Started with an O'Hara's Stout, so I really don't need another beer, but it's a sacrifice I've got to make for the good of the project. Pam the bartender has got to be here until midnight, so I coaxed her to switch off the hokey dance contest on TV and put on some music she likes, Tom Petty. She's cleaning up, and I'm making this movie. I busted out of the anchor at Charlevoix at 8:30 a.m. The skipper of Pool Party yelled out as I passed, "Where are you headed?" "The UP," I shouted back. He put his hand to his ear and I shouted again, but then one of his fishing lines tugged and he was no longer interested in my answer. The reason he didn't hear me was because my answer was silly. I wasn't headed for the UP that morning. I was going for Beaver Island. I left him and the grumbling cement plant behind me. It's owned by the Brazilians, I've since found out. A cement plant that looks and sounds like what I imagine a nuclear reactor would. Looking back at the compass, I noticed the needle had fallen off its pivot and the entire bezel was gone. This is the same bezel that had been frozen in place at the start of the trip. It would have taken some serious force to pop that bezel off, so there must have been a minor explosion from internal pressure, perhaps due to the dramatic temperature changes, from this morning's 40-degree chill to the warmth of direct sunlight. There was a strong chemical smell from whatever liquid had been in there. I stuffed the remains into the pack. I'd have to rely on the new GPS-enabled iPhone now. Silva Compass features handy exploding bezel. I skated north on southish winds for the better part of the day, coming in sight of Beaver and watching her resolve from dark blobs into an actual island. The wind reports called for the blow to fade around 1 p.m., so rather than take a lazy northerly course straight to the island, I decided to make faster vectors to the northeast and northwest to get close quickly. If I could get within a couple of miles of the island before the wind puttered out, I was probably good. I made it to the southern tip and proceeded up the east coast by 2 p.m. The wind was indeed changing, but I was within 1,000 feet of shore, so I decided to anchor and take a swim. It was a perfect sandy bottom at about 30 feet of depth. The sun was shining and the water was brisk, lovely. There were a couple of cottages visible on the beach with long stretches of sand between them. Why not land and reconnoiter? The shore was unusual. Polished gravel shoals or jetties running parallel to shore, sheltering deeper pools that lapped sandy beaches. The ducks and gulls watched with increasing annoyance as I approached their spots. I pulled up Hello World and explored. There were many signs of thriving wildlife and bright orange ribbons tied to trees as if marking a trail. The juxtaposition was kind of depressing. I followed the ribbons and came to Donna's place, an empty cottage often rented, judging by the sign on the door. I headed back to the boat and made ready to launch, firing up the pupinator and debating my next move. Farther north was St. James Bay and likely a decent cell signal. That seemed the best course of action. I pushed off and moved north on an easy south wind. Sure enough, a big cell tower showed up just before St. James Bay. I surprised Gretchen and then my parents by calling and reporting my location. I could imagine Gretchen telling her husband James, "Dan Kelly's on Beaver Island." This is the same James who bet me $1 I couldn't start an engine with the power of my mind. He also scared the dickens out of my dad by ranting on about how dangerous the big lake was just before I launched. Of course it's dangerous, but my dad is already shitting bricks. He doesn't need the husband of my producer getting him even more wound up. Actually, maybe it was good for him. It's certainly made for a sweet moment. Lightly tossing off my arrival at Beaver to my parents and thinking about how that might further open James to the possibilities of the universe. I gotta pay him back for all the awesome saunas he hosts. At around 5 p.m., I nosed into the bay and found the public beach just where Gretchen said it would be. My approach felt like some kind of necromancy, a perfect curving course right up to the beach that required no tacking. I was greeted by Jim, local grocery store owner. We chatted for a bit, and he handed me a beer. My kind of place, Beaver Island. I asked the locals about camping under Hello World. "It's probably illegal, but no one will bother you," was the response. Awesome. public beach on Beaver Island. That evening, I called Gretchen's people to schedule interviews. I ate a greasy double dinner at the Shamrock and told the Hungarian waitress that I loved her in her native tongue. I was just kidding. I didn't really love her. But that's the only phrase my grandmother was able to pass on to me. She was startled, the waitress, that is. Afterwards, we both fell back into our respective roles and nothing much else happened. I had friendly conversations with my table neighbors, charged batteries, and copied files. Continued on episode 025. You've been listening to episode 024, Crazy, the Daughter of Godcast. We've traveled beyond the known and smack into the exhilaration zone, gathering artifacts of sustainable civilizations along the way and becoming more than ever. So psyched you've decided to be another reason to remember. As always, I invite your applause, raspberries, and catcalls because you're clearly one of the cool people since you're still listening to me after 24 weeks, and I only want to be famous among cool people. Let us all celebrate as the evolved, the experimental, the visionary, the fun-loving. We rock. This is the podcast for anyone who chooses to rock, to shine, to be both mortal and divine. Also, coincidentally, to rhyme.